Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Malcolm Guite is a poet priest and chaplain of Girton College of the University of Cambridge. He's also a singer-songwriter and a biographer of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. As Jeremy Begbie has said, Malcolm Guite has established himself as one of the most important Christian poets of our time. I couldn't agree more. Malcolm Guite, thank you so much for making time to be on the Habit Podcast. Your poems have given me important ways of reimagining the faith and my place in the world and what kind of world we live in. So thank you for what you've done there.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm glad you got the word imagination in there and talked about reimagining. One of the things that's been a burden of my work, both in poetry, but also in my other scholarship, has been to recover this essential idea that the imagination, or at least the baptized imagination, is a truth-bearing faculty, that in order to know things well, we have to engage our imagination. Yeah. And I think we've had a very false split in our culture between reason and imagination. I think they're both, as it were, God-given faculties for coming to know what is the case. And I think, therefore, we sometimes need not only to imagine, but as you said, to reimagine things, to, as Seamus Heaney has this lovely line in one of his poems where he talks about the need and chance to salvage everything.
Oh, wow.
To re-envisage the zenith and glimpsed jewels of any gift mistakenly abased. And then he goes on to say, read poems as prayers. The context of the poem is Heaney remembering a time when he'd been to confession and he'd been given this advice by a priest. And he fuses that memory with a much earlier memory of having been given a kaleidoscope as a little kid and having accidentally plunged it all, in a butt of muddied water. It was all silted up.
Yeah.
But in the poem, the kaleidoscope that's been abased resurfaces like a marvelous light ship, he says.
Oh, wow.
And then he hears again the voice of this priest saying, the voice that spoke once from behind a grill, and this is the line, spoke again about the need and chance to salvage everything, to re-envisage the zenith and glimpsed jewels of any gift mistakenly abased. What came to nothing could always be replenished. Oh. Read poems as prayers, he said.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing. I mean, Heaney is astonishing.
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, almost everything is mistakenly abased, right?
One of the gifts mistakenly abased by our culture for about the last 200 or 300 years is the gift of imagination. Hmm. That we've sidelined it. We've said, oh, it's only about the subjective. Out there is the objective world of dry, rational facts. But it's all quantity and no quality. And we've abased that gift of intuitively knowing the truth and value of things and expressing that in warm and poetic imagery rather than simply dissolving everything into a set of tiny particles or mathematical formulae.
Yeah. Is it Voyage of the Dawn Treader where somebody says, in our world, a star is gas and dust or whatever.
That's right. That's a wonderful moment. It's Eustace Clarence Scott. It's kind of, he's basically a reformed character, but at this point he's still got a bit of his old. And he's introduced to a character as sort of mythological, mythopoetic being who used to be a star, in fact.
Yeah.
And he's told he's a star, and he says, oh, in our world, a star is merely a ball of gases and flames exploding into the cold vacuity of space. And the star replies to him, said, even in your world, that's not what a star is. It's merely what a star is made of.
Yeah.
Such a vital distinction, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
It's the distinction that Aristotle makes, in fact, between accidents and substance, The accidents is just what a thing happens to be made out of, but the substance is what it truly is in form.
Yeah.
And everything has a substantial as well as an accidental cause. And in a sense, our science is simply the science of accidents, not accidents, T-E-N-T-S, but E-N-C-E. And,
yeah. You know,
there are other dimensions to which only the imagination has access.
And that view that you're expressing here opens up, again, I mean, it opens up everything to poetry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it makes poetry
past what things are made of and to what they are.
Yeah. Also, it makes poetry one of the, as it were, in some respects, scientific instruments available to us to try and understand what is the case.
Huh, yeah.
So it's interesting that when Coleridge came in his Biography Literaria to look back after 20 years on what he and Wordsworth thought they were up to in that miraculous summer, you know, in the 1797-98, that Annus Mirabilis, when they wrote the lyrical ballads, and he wrote Mariner, and Ancient Mariner and Kubla Khan. Anyway, looking back on it, Coleridge doesn't say, I mean, it's very interesting, the way we were taught in secular universities about poetry and literature and poetic movements was very much that literature and the arts were about a private, subjective world of artsiness, and you know, poetry is a sort of imaginary compensation for the kind of grimness of the world. Whereas what actually, and they would then romantic poetry supremely say, but actually what these two founders of romantic poetry were up to, according to Coleridge, was not to compensate us with by inward fantasy for the dead and meaningless concatenation of atoms in which we happen to be circulating. We aimed on awakening the mind's attention, removing the film of familiarity, and restoring to us that vision and the freshness and depth of nature for which we have eyes that see not, ears that hear not, and hearts that neither feel nor understand. So they weren't trying to make stuff up. They were trying to take away this film, which he says our selfishness and solicitude has cast over the world, and unveil a deeper but equally real truth about nature, which is more than just the surfaces we see.
You're talking about the idea of reconnecting us with reality, you know, not creating reality in our brains, yeah, but connecting us with what's actually.
I mean, obviously, their poetry did involve also making up stories, and you know, and the Rime of the Ancient Mariner is, you know, is not actually a piece of straightforward what you would have seen with a camcorder visual reportage. You know, that's not the point. So, in fact, Coleridge, in the very same passage in Biographia that he says awakening the mind's attention to the loveliness of nature, he also says that there's a way of telling a story in which, as it were, asking of your reader, as he says in the famous phrase, that willing suspension of disbelief that for the moment constitutes poetic faith. But then he goes on to say that I might transfer, in fact, he says it just what he says, I might transfer from our inner nature those truths which will win for these shadows of imagination, that willing suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
In other words, the shadows of imagination are bodying forth certain truths from the inner nature. And in fact, of course, Shakespeare had put the same thing much, you know, even more clearly much earlier in the Midsummer Night's Dream, where he talks about, you know, the poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. Mm-hmm. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. It's a bodying forth of the inner into the
outer. That's the same speech, isn't it, where we talk about apprehending and not comprehending?
That's right. He talks about how imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends. And I think our ways of knowing are on a kind of spectrum between apprehend and comprehend. Yeah. And we move back and forth. I mean, apprehend, you know, the prehend part of that obviously is to do with taking hold of something, like having a prehensile tail you can hold things with. So you can just about reach out to the apprehensible and touch a bit of it. The comprehensible, you can get your mind right the way around. Yeah. But actually, what you need all the time is a way in which you can woo the apprehensions, as it were, gradually towards comprehension, and also open the comprehensions out into new apprehensions. Yeah. And that mediating between those ways of knowing, imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends, says Shakespeare. Imagination is precisely the means whereby we do that.
Oh, exchange. Yeah. Love it. Because one way to make sure we comprehend things is to limit them to things that are small enough that we can reach around.
Right. Oh, mine are right. Yeah, you know. And the idea of a God who both gives us a world we can begin to comprehend, but constantly beckons us through that comprehension and apprehension is fundamental to the Christian faith. So, you know, the whole point about, you know, the light shines in the darkness has never comprehended it. You know, it can't be contained. And there's a kind of symbolic dynamic. I mean, I believe these things literally and truly happened as well. But between, on the one hand, the womb of the incarnation and the virgin womb and the empty tomb, the tomb that had never been used by anybody else before. And one of them speaks of the God who is bodied forth and comes to us. Hmm. The other, the empty tomb, why seek you the living among the dead? The way he appears and then he disappears and then he draws them and then he is the God who is always leading us beyond what we thought we knew.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He comes to us as we are, that we may know him as we are. But then he leads us through that knowledge to something more.
Yeah, that's great. So you work, I read in an interview about your childhood with poetry, and I was really interested in this idea that you said for a long time you were not exposed to poetry in any bookish context. It was just something you heard with your ears in your family.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, I was very fortunate that my mother, particularly, my father to some extent, but certainly my mother, knew huge amounts of poetry by heart and, as it were, thought naturally in poetry. So it's not that she sat me down and said, now I'm going to recite you a poem. It would be in the middle of something that we were doing or saying that she would just start to quote poetry. And a lot of the poetry that she liked was strongly rhythmical, and you could immediately feel the lift and beat and pattern of it. So, you know, as I say, we used to go out, we used to travel back and forth from Africa, where I was born, to England on ships each year. And I loved it, that moment when the boat left the harbour and, you know, the land started to recede and you'd see the wake of the boat sort of unfolding up. And I'd look at it and, you know, be happy. But my mother would look at it and stand beside me and say, the fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrow followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea, which, you know, you sit me down and go like, now this is Coleridge and one day this will be very important to you, my boy. You know, quoting it. And I loved it. So I had inherited, fortunately from her, that same ear for poetry and more or less a capacity to remember it first time off. Or if I said a poem a couple of times because I liked it, then I would discover that it was in there anyway and it would come out. So I didn't see it written down for a while. And eventually when I did, you know, and I saw that, oh, you could read it, you know, but it didn't have that bookish feel. It certainly never felt like anything to be studied. Of course, much later I came to realize that naturally that is in fact how poetry started. And that the original great poetry, the epics of the world, the Homers of this world, but also the folk poetry of the earliest times in Europe and in England, were not written down. They were part of an oral tradition. They were ways of remembering things. They were naturally musical language. Yeah. And I still believe that poetry has to be, as it were, sounded into the air and tasted on the tongue, really to be understood and appreciated as poetry.
Yeah. I ran across an article a while back. I mean, I say a while back, probably 15 years ago, about a great epic poem in India that had been recited by a you know, not a tribe of people, but the Levites, basically, of their world, and it had been this huge, long, much longer than Homer's epics. Mm. and that they could recite. And then somebody got the idea of let's write this down so that it doesn't get lost. And pretty soon after it got written down, the people's ability to recite it and remember it went away.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is an ancient trope. I mean, you may remember, I think it's in the dialogue, the Phaedrus, in Plato. There's a conversation where somebody tells the story of the invention of writing, which the Greeks attributed to the Egyptians. And somebody goes up to, in the story, you know, somebody goes up to Pharaoh and shows what would be hieroglyphics and say, look, we've invented a way of remembering. And the Pharaoh refuses the gift because he says, no, you've invented a way of forgetting.
Yes. Yeah.
You've externalized the thing and no longer comes from its sources. So, yeah, I mean, the feats of memory in the ancient world are truly astonishing, you know, the power. We've definitely gained some things with literacy, but we've lost some things too. And poetry, because it is an archaic thing, and it still keeps the memory of that oral tradition, because poetry cares immensely about the sound of language as well as about its meaning.
Yeah.
Or good poetry does, I think.
Does everything you write have a pretty strict form, meter, rhyme?
Yeah, I mean, that's in a sense where I have, as it were, begged to differ from the mainstream of contemporary poetry. Ironically, my use of convention and form makes me a radical rebel rather than a formal conventionalist, you know, so yeah. Such is life. But I very strongly, well, partly because I think I admire the beauty of it, the poetry that I love, the great poems of Coleridge or Shelley or Keats, or, you know, going earlier to George Herbert and Donne and so on, uses form very beautifully. So I think it is intrinsically beautiful in itself. And secondly, I actually think the constraints of form, the fact that you have to keep the meter and you can only have five syllables and five, you know, stresses and 10 syllables in the line if it's pentameter, or that you have a certain rhyme scheme. I think those constraints, far from being, as it were, a handicap, are a positive advantage and a spur to creativity. They make you think again. They, you know, there's a famous, there's a letter of Blake's where he's talking about learning the art of being an engraver. And he talks about how the most important line, the first line that you draw in an engraving, is what Blake called the bounding line. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing the poet Geoffrey Hill once, years ago, lecturing about Blake and saying that bounding was a really interesting word for Blake to use. He didn't say boundary or binding, either of which were available to his words. But bounding is one of those English words which has a double meaning, that it can mean bounding in or bounding with energy. Grace are bounding to the chief. And he then went on to say that it's precisely the bounding line in the Blake's poetry which gives it its creative energy.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, a modern poet writing a poem about a tiger would think that because the tiger was free to roam around the forest, that they should have long loping lines and short lines and things written big and small. And whereas, you know, and no frame or symmetry in the verse. Whereas Blake goes, you know, Blake uses this strong meter and representing a tiger, tiger burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? And in a sense, the energy of the tiger is all the more concentrated and fearful because of the fearful symmetry and frame of the poem. And Hill went on to say in this lecture that the constraints of the poem, its rules and limitations of form, rather than being a prison or a dead hand, in the right hands, in a poet who knows what he's doing with them, are actually much more like the walls of a furnace. That, you know, you put the fire in the furnace or in the brazier, it burns much more brightly than if it was loose. It has an intenser heat. And of course, he then went on to show how that's the other image in the tiger poem, you know. I think it's fair. I've written poetry in blank verse. Uh-huh. I've written in slightly freer verse just occasionally where I vary the line length, but I've never written a poem which didn't have meter or consideration of form, you know. Uh-huh. I've not written those kind of modern poems which I think of as really as chopped prose, you know, where its right. claim to be a poem rests simply on the fact that the lines don't reach the edge of the page.
Yeah. Yeah. When I teach creative writing, I always require, when we do the poetry part of the class, I just say, you've got to write at least in meter, and I prefer that it rhyme, just for the very reasons you're saying. Those constraints give you somewhere to start, give you something to do, and make you discover some things you didn't know you could do.
Absolutely, yeah. And at least when you're finished, you've got something that whatever else you may need to find or learn how to do, it at least has the virtue of pattern and rhythm and the pleasure of repeated sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you write a lot of sonnets, and I think a sonnet is such a great form for talking about Christian truth, right? Because it's in one direction, and then you have a turn, and
you have the volta, and also it kind of concentrates on that. Also, there's a curious thing where I think one is drawn sometimes to one's opposite or corrective, and I think one of the reasons why I like the sonnet, which is by definition a brief form, you can see the end of it. It makes this little square on the page. I mean, you know when you're going to stop before you start, and you necessarily write a sonnet towards its final line, And I think that's a particularly important form for me because by nature, I'm the opposite. I'm very loquacious. I can go on, you try to stop me, My mother used to say to me, you have the gift of the gab very galloping. She also used to say, your tongue will get you hung. And I can remember when I first started writing the sonnets that became Sounding the Seasons, my book of 70 sonnets going through the Christian year, which I did in a context of articulating verse for a church, for the church I was serving, and a reflection on the gospel and the seasons. And so I began to occasionally try these from the pulpit. And I remember one of the congregations saying to me almost in a whisper at the hour, sort of with a look of saying, Malcolm, why didn't you tell us earlier that you could do this in just 14 lines?
Oh, that's great. Poetry had a role in your coming back to the Christian faith, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I mean, it was. It's kind of had sort of roles at various stages, but it had a very important one, kind of one of these turning points. I mean, I was brought up in a Christian household, for which I'm very grateful now. But I guess, like a lot of kids of my generation, and probably all of us for different reasons, I kind of rebelled against that and turned my back on it in my mid-teens. I was about 14 or 15 when I think I decided that I was an atheist, and I did it as I saw it, in a very thoroughgoing way. I thought, right, either this is the case or it isn't the case. And I believed falsely, as it turns out, but I never believed that kind of science had disproved it all. And it was, fairy tales and people thinking and stuff. And I went in exactly the opposite direction. So I became a very reductive scientist. I wanted to be a marine biologist anyway, but we didn't have Richard Dawkins famously in those days, but we had the equivalent guy was a guy called B.F. Skinner. He was a sort of behaviorist scientist, who very much thought you could account for everything in everything, including all of human behavior, could be accounted for in entirely classic, as it were, Newtonian terms of action and reaction. Mm-hmm. One thing forces another thing to happen, and you just have to manipulate what the forces are, and you can control things. And so I tried to believe for quite a long time that we were literally just a random concatenation of mutually rebounding particles, which by some bizarre chance had thrown up this accidental epiphenomenon, this side effect of thinking you were a person and being around for a bit. And I remember being very proud of the word epiphenomenon, And I was a precocious 14 and 15-year-old, And the only, this situation was fundamentally absurd. And, apart from experiencing bouts of existential angst, all you could do was sort of contemplate the void. But anyway, I was endeavouring, therefore, to find the scientific reductive explanation of everything that happened. Which is one way of trying to sort of distance oneself from the emotions of one's own stormy youth. Anyway, I was taken by an aunt of mine to Keats's house. I didn't really know anything about Keats, but there was the Ode to a Nightingale on the wall. And I read this poem really because I had nothing better to do. And it was extraordinary because I was in the room, you know, where you could look out through the casements and there was the tree that the nightingale had sung in, you know, that magical people, you know, kind of 200 years previously. And I started reading this poem. And as you may remember, it has a very kind of unpromising start, you know, in terms of low register, you know, it begins, "My heart ache. And a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past and leafy woods had sunk." So I was reading this in some moody 15, 16-year-old. And I was going, oh yeah, you know, ache, dull, drains, sunk, leafy. I'm with you, mate, you know. Anyway, so I was sitting there moodily reading it and going, yeah, fair enough. And then, of course, as you remember, the poem suddenly and inexplicably out of a moment of sheer grace lifts as the bird sings. So he goes, you know, just after that, after the word sunk, it suddenly goes, "'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thy happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees, in some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless, singest of summer with a full-throated ease." And I was going, like, what was that? I mean, that just, you know, I was astonished. I just didn't even know English could sound like that. So I was reading this poem, and of course the poem ushers you through, and it's kind of hypersensory poem because he goes out in the dark, you know, and you know, "I cannot tell what flowers are at my feet or what soft incense hangs upon the boughs, but in embalmed darkness guess each sweet." So I was really with him. And then this extraordinary thing happens just towards the end of the poem. First of all, he has this, Ruth comes in from the Bible, and he sees this woman standing, you know, hearing a nightingale, you know, when sick for home, she stood in tears amidst the alien corn. And then, suddenly out of nowhere, he produces this image of magic casements, of these windows, there's like windows at the back of the poem, opening onto something, you know, of charmed open magic case, opening on perilous seas in fairy land. Then you come back forlorn, the very word is like a bell. So I read this and it was a genuinely numinous experience. I didn't have that word then, but that's what it was. And it's not like, oh, I've read Keats, I'm a Christian. It's nothing like that at all. But what happened was it cracked open the kind of concrete, materialist, reductive explanations of the world that I had. Because I walked out of that and I said, there is no way that poem is the result of an unwinding enzyme, you know. There's a distinction between a chemical reaction that I can produce, you know, with titrating in a lab, and the Ode to a Nightingale. Both the Ode to a Nightingale, as Keats writes it, and the Ode to a Nightingale, as this callow teenager read it in Hampstead, you know, in the 70s, something happened there which is, has an overplus, is more than the sum of any of its parts. And it's got something to do with the sound, with the bird flying, and with the windows opening. That those things are more than themselves, you know. Their sense of the bird retreating further and further beyond you, singing you in the next grove, and yet you're having heard it and being drawn towards it. So in a sense, that set me off on something. It opened me to the possibility that there was a mystery behind the appearance of things. That somewhere there were magic casements that would open onto perilous seas. And in the end, that led me to the gospel and to faith, but not directly, and there were many indirect paths. But I think that was a moment of spiritual opening. And subsequently, of course, when I came to Cambridge, by that time an agnostic rather than an atheist, so therefore at least open to a possibility, not discounting or foreclosing on things, I began to find, very much like Lewis, that the poets I really loved were all Christian poets and were making the case for Christianity in ways that cold prose couldn't. And I would very much echo almost exactly what Lewis says, you know, in Surprised by Joy, about his experiences and, you know, reading English at Oxford, mine English at Cambridge, which was that he says it's in effect in in Surprise by Joy, he says, I suppose in a way my imagination was baptized before I was. And the rest of me took a little bit longer to catch up. And that was very much my experience.
Yeah. Now, you didn't start writing poetry, though, until after you had become a priest. Is that correct?
Well, I didn't start writing. I didn't start writing poetry. And I did have a. Of course, I wrote poetry as a teenager. Once I discovered Keats, you know, I was a Keats wannabe. I mean, and I wrote lots of, you know, pastiche, sort of, you know, romantic Keatsian, sub Keatsian, lush poetry full of quoths and doths and prithies, you know. But, and I was at least trying to make that sound. I had another go at writing poetry as an undergraduate, which is probably slightly better poetry, but was, of course, a bit academic. But what happened actually was that, and I suppose another best part of training. And then when I was ordained, in a sense, the extraordinary experience of being a parish priest and of officiating at the liturgy and initiating people into this gorgeously made pattern of sound and movement and form and gesture and metaphor and meaning, which was transformative for them and for me. That, in a sense, is the thing I'd always wanted to do in poetry anyway. But I was kind of doing it in the given poems, as it were, of the faith, which are the liturgies and the hymns. But eventually I came to realize that that other thing I'd loved so much needed to come out too, but that it could come out into its right place now. I think when I was ardently hoping, when I was a full-on, you know, Keats wannabe and sort of playing romantic poetry air guitar, you know, in my 20s, I would have, you know, poetry would have become a false religion to me in a way. And I needed to, I mean, you know, famously, as I was at T.E. Holm, I think, said romanticism is spilled religion. But that doesn't mean that when you found the unspilled cup on the altar, you don't still notice the joy and beauty of the romantic poetry. But now you kind of have a context for it. It's also what to do with what Keats, what Lewis says about first things and second things. That if you put first things first, you get the second things as well. You know, find Christ and take the cosmos thrown in, you know. But there's no point in gaining the whole world and losing your soul, you know.
I love it. You know, I had every intention in this conversation of talking about your sonnet. I don't call it a sonnet cycle, but you know, after prayer that you wrote, inspired by George Herbert's poem Prayer.
Prayer, yeah, that's right.
We're almost out of time, but I just want to say for the record, your sonnets on that poem have really opened up that poem for me.
It's just literally, it's a list of images. I mean, he doesn't even use the verb to be. So he says, prayer, the church's banquet, angel's age, God's birthing man returning to his birth, the soul in paraphrase, heart in purgatory, and so on. So it goes on. And every one of those is richly and beautifully what prayer is. But he doesn't tell you why. He leaves you to do all the thinking and imagining, and he just gives you this core thing. And I was astonished at the sheer generosity of that poem, because you can, as a poet, you can wait a long time for an image, you know, and when you get a really good one, you can get poems out of this one, you know. Whereas here's Herbert comes along and he gives you, by my reckoning, 26 absolute gems, all in one sonnet, 14 lines, for free. And then he just adds the words, something understood, which is almost not only a conclusion, but a kind of offer or a challenge. You know, what are the some things that you will understand? So, I used to do quiet days and retreats based on that poem. And one of the things I used to say to people was, you know, any one of these images could be starting point for a new poem. And then one day I was on retreat myself and I thought, well, maybe I should take that seriously. And so I began a sequence. 27 sonnets, which is after prayer. I mean, I don't know how much time we have. Maybe I could read one of them to you or something. But
I'd love it if you'd read one or two. I don't know if you have your own ideas.
Do you have any particular ones you'd like to hear?
You know what? I would love to hear the Christian Plummet. I want to hear. I've got a lot I want to hear, but let's do the Christian Plummet if you don't mind.
Okay, we'll do that. I mean, this one's kind of quite a dark one, but we don't stay down here, but it's really important that we have to go down here to understand. So the Christian Plummet is an image. is the image of a lead line, you know, that they used on a ship where they would lower it down, you know, to find out how much water there is under the keel. And that was the original context. Prayer is like a plummet let down. But I just love the way he put the word Christian and plummet together.
Yeah.
And I thought about that in the modern sense. I happen to be one of those people who occasionally really plummets down in their feelings. And I think there are quite a few Christians like that. And I think experiencing that doesn't make you not a Christian. You know, on the contrary, it may be a very important part of your role within the wider faith. So that's partly where this is coming from. So the Christian plummet. Down into the icy depths you plunge, the cold, dark undertow of your depression. Even your memories of light made strange as you fall further from all comprehension. You feel as though they've thrown you overboard, your fellow Christians on the sunlit deck, a stone-cold Jonah on whom scorn is poured, a sacrifice to save them from the wreck. But someone has their hands on your long line. You sound for them the depths they sail above. One who takes Jonah as his only sign sinks lower still to hold you in his love. And though you cannot see or speak or breathe, the everlasting arms are underneath.
Mm. I love it, Malcolm. The reason I wanted you to read that poem was for that line, you sound for them the depths they sail above. And that feels like, to me, a big part of the poet's job.
Yeah, that's a very, thank you for singling that line out. I think that is exactly it, that sense of sounding a depth, getting into, and we are such a speedy surface skimming culture at the moment. That's why we need this opportunity to slow language down and the mind's attention and let it sink into a depth.
Yeah. Well, that's something that your work has done for me, Malcolm. And so thank you for that. I love the way your cycle ends, you know, your sonnet on the line, the image, something understood.
Yeah.
And you say, I share as pilgrims are still on the brink. I share as pilgrims should some of the somethings I've understood. And so I really appreciate the ways in which you have shared the somethings you have understood. And when I read, especially this, I mean, one thing I think about this cycle, this 26 sonnet cycle on Herbert's poem, is that any of us could, as you said, it would be a great exercise to write more of these poems.
Yeah. Oh, you could. Yeah. I mean, if I were to do this again now, I could write, you know, 26, 27 different sonnets because there's so much in each of those images.
Yeah. And we, in terms of, you know, the somethings that you've understood, we all understand something a little different. And together, as we each, what we've given account of what we've seen, we get a fuller picture together of
I think that in the very word understand, in the sense when you understand something, you aren't standing under, as it were, something which is greater than you. I love, there's a great line, the modern Irish poet Michael O'Shiel has got a poem about, it's about being out in the evening in the garden, having eaten a meal and the suns and the stars are coming out, and dancing spontaneously, you know, putting a record on, dancing with his wife in the garden. And then they stop and look up. And the last line of the poem, it's a great line, he says, we stand under stars we can never understand.
Oh, that's so good. I love it. All right, I got to ask one more question. I know you've got to go. I need to go too. You've probably been answering this question for the last 40 minutes, but who are the writers who make you want to write?
Well, that's a great thing. In the first instance, I mean, it was definitely Keats. Keats is the person who made me want to be a poet in the sense, and I still have something Keatsy, and I wanted that really rich, beautiful sound, which I felt was missing from contemporary English poetry. But and Coleridge made me want to write in another way, in that Coleridge really gave me a grounds for understanding that the imagination is a gift from God and that it can be done in consonance with the Logos, that we can have a repetition in the finite mind, as Coleridge put it, of the eternal and infinite act of creation in the I Am. So Coleridge is another person. I think there are a lot of contemporary writers, not necessarily just in poetry, where you think, oh, you know, that's good. I'm glad, you know, somebody put it that way. Obviously, in the 20th century, for me, the Inklings, Lewis and Tolkien and Charles Williams and Owen Barfield are important. You know, there are some pretty impressive, you know, contemporary poets and writers. Among the contemporary Christian poets, there were people who would spur me on and I think, gosh, that's good. I'd like to do something like that. There's Lucy Shaw. I think she's extraordinary, and Scott Cairns, you know, are really fine. And although I've got a half-written novel, but I'm not really novice, but there are some people still writing, I think, in that great mythopoeic tradition. You know, Susanna Clarke, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, that's an amazing book. So there are contemporary writers too. In theological writers, I mean, there are some writers that just put their finger on the relationship between imaginative art and really good, substantial theology. One of the people, both in print and in person, who's immensely inspired me is Jeremy Begbie. He writes mainly about music and theology. Yeah. But he and I were involved in a thing called Theology Through the Arts. And he's just had a book recently called Redeeming Transcendence, which really brings together the sort of apparent, you know, some people would set an opposition between Christian doctrine and artistic freedom. And Begbie never does that. He really shows you how the great Christian doctrines are the foundation and stimulus of artistic freedom.
Well, Malcolm, thank you so much for being here. This has been such a treat for me, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Okay, great. It's been good to be with you.
The Rabbit Room has partnered with Lipscomb University to make this podcast possible. Lipscomb has graciously given us access to their recording studio in the Center for Entertainment and Arts building. We're so grateful for their sponsorship, their encouragement, and the good work they do in Nashville. Special shout out as well to Jess Ray for letting us use her song Too Good as part of this podcast. Visit jessraymusic.com to hear more of her beautiful songs.
Habit Membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.
This podcast was produced by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. All our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.